Welcome.
Thank you so much. You guys are awesome. And I can't wait to talk about how to empower over a billion people, talk about values, and maybe even talk about some other things you may be interested in.
Yes, for sure. And I do know we do have this typically this or that that we ask. Do we want to ask him a few things?
I'm going to ask him a few things because okay. I like to build that rapport first. And so I want to know, are you a coffee or tea person?
Tea.
Ooh.
Tea. Okay. Morning person or night owl? I know you're not a night owl. You said you go to bed early.
Yeah, I'm morning all the way.
Yeah, because you did talk about your sleep schedule and that you would win that in an Olympic sport.
Hall of Fame.
That's incredible. Are you a text or call guy?
Call, for sure.
Oh, wow.
Wow, okay.
Okay. So I've been trying to text you because you gave me your number. That's why I better just call you.
Okay. Beach vacation or mountain getaway?
Beach vacation.
That's why he lives in LA.
I like that. Okay, nice. All right, we won't go on too long from here now. Let's get into
your mission and what you do.
What do you do?
On a day-to-day, how do you operationalize making 1 billion people happy?
Yeah, so I am a community builder, and everything I do, investments that I make, coaching, speaking, meetups, holding court, all the different TV shows, podcasts, business development deals that I do, everything is aimed towards building this community of people that want to help each other and know people to help each other. And it's never been easier to build community than it is today. And understanding value and being able to articulate value to exceed what I ask for is the key skill set that I've learned over the years to help build this community of people that not only help each other and know people that help each other, they buy from each other and sell for each other for life. Mm-hmm. But they also are kind, they share values. And having this community enables us to truly create a collective consciousness that can change the world.
And so when you say, and that's what seems so, I think, so compelling is that you're making people happy because you're working with good people, but then there's also a financial return to it as well. So it's like you're sharing or exchanging this, it sounds like these emotional values, you're working with good people, but then also you're kind of helping each other's bottom lines because you're doing business together too. So it feels like a win-win. Is that kind of what you're after?
Yeah, I think people don't understand value and they feel bad about receiving, even though if you do the math, if you receive less than you give, you're going to end up at zero and not be able to help anyone. So I empower people with the idea when we receive, and it's our responsibility, it's our accountability to be able to receive, we can give more value than we receive, but we need to receive value. And when we feel our best, when we're most purposeful, passionate, and even profitable, it's because we're capable. See, the best feeling we have as human beings is when we're capable and able to help somebody else. So every time you don't receive, you're cheating other people. The greatest feeling that they have is the human experience provides. Every time, so, hey, can I do this for you? Would you like me or would it help you if? And you don't say yes, you're actually cheating that person of value, mm-hmm. a great value. So I teach the infinite loop of giving, which isn't just you give more to receive more. It's give more, utilize gratitude, empathy, accountability in order to identify all that you're given. Because a lot of people are given so many wonderful things, but they feel punished because of their perspective. They don't feel promoted, protected, loved, perfected by what they're given. And then they're ones that do feel as if they're given stuff, they don't receive it because they feel bad, they feel guilty, they feel resentful, they feel offended. And this infinite loop of more than enough is canceled. And so I help people understand not only values, which we can go through, but how to articulate value to exceed what you're asking for and how to receive and even ask for more.
And I think you gave a really tangible example when you spoke at this conference that I think will be good for listeners about giving people the opportunity to give and not robbing them of that. And I think you mentioned going out to dinner with your mother, for example. Can you share that as just a very tangible example of how we sometimes rob people of the opportunity to give?
Yeah. You know, I worked so hard to create financial security in my family beyond my intimate family, my parents, my grandparents, my community and relatives. I work really hard, but I didn't understand the cheating that I was doing, because every time I went out or did something, I wouldn't receive from them. They would offer, can I split the bill with you? Or can I pay for this? And I, oh, no, no, absolutely not. And I started to realize, especially with my siblings and my mom, that I was cheating them, as now I'm a parent. And I know the great joy I have when I'm able and capable of providing for my family, to cheat my mom of her capability of being able to provide for hers.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I actually feel like somewhere in like one of my Jewish classes at some point, I've heard about like if someone even like the idea of like if someone offers you water, even that you, even if you're like don't want it, you should always take it for the idea. I feel like I've heard this somewhere. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, like one of It's true. It is just like you're not taking away someone's gift to give to you, because it does fuel us. We as human beings are built to give in a way. And a lot of us might feel robbed of that. And whether it's they don't have money to give, but they have water to give, just take what someone can give you. And so I think you've tapped into something, David, that has like, I mean, really like ancient wisdom behind it as well. David had kind of a wake the hell up moment where he lost everything. I don't know.
I definitely want to talk about that. I want to talk about what happened? What do you mean by lost everything? How bad are we talking? What happened? We want all the tea.
You got it. No problem. Number one, it was my greatest fear in the world to lose everything and go bankrupt. But I lost over $100 million and went bankrupt.
Wow.
I had 33 homes in San Diego at the time, moved into a rented house with rented furniture and one car. I had, truth story, I had so many cars, I didn't know in the bankruptcy where they all were. And so even the bankruptcy court was like, what do you mean you're not sure where this car is? I'm like, well, it might be in Montana or Arizona or Vegas at one of my other properties. I just don't know. And now I learned the lesson from my mom during this period, because as much difficulty and struggle losing everything would have, the worst part of it was telling my mom. As I mentioned before, I have this extraordinary mom who raised six kids on her own, worked two jobs, one as a second grade teacher at a private Jewish school, packed her dinner in a paper bag and took us in her country squire station wagon to fill up turnstiles at convenience stores with greeting cards just so we could eat. All my siblings except for me went to the Ivy Leagues, Harvard, Penn, Columbia. Not only went to the Ivy Leagues, but graduated summa cum laude, never got a B. My mom was exceptional. All I wanted to do was to buy her a house and a car and create financial security for her. So when I lost everything, to tell her, I thought it would wreck her. Now, beyond that, I also made one other mistake, is I lost her home, which was great irony, because the only reason I wanted to be rich was to buy that home for her. And here I forgot to take my name off of her title, and she got drawn into the bankruptcy, and the house was taken back from her. So when I told her, I could barely breathe, let alone speak. And when I rang the doorbell, she came to the door and saw me crying. This happened, you know, in 2008, so 17 and a half years ago. And I still get choked up because I remember answering the door, terrified. What's the matter? What's the matter? Are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. Is Julie, my wife, okay? Yeah, she, are the kids, what's the matter, David? And I couldn't get it out, like a four-year-old trying to... You guys know that feeling.
Like, use your words.
Use your words. And I broke out, Mom, I lost everything, including your house. You have to move. And she looked at me. She said, oh, are you okay? I said, Mom, I don't think you're me. I lost everything. You need to move out of your house. I lost your home. Oh, do you need some money? Do you need money? And I said, Mom, I'm serious. I lost everything. I don't need your money. You need to move. She said, son, it'll be fine. What can I do to help you? I said, Mom, why am I being punished? Why am I being punished? I just have to tell you, I don't believe in God. And this was that moment of humility that my mom smirked at me. She was so calm And she just smirked at me. And I said, what are you laughing at? She said, oh, sweetheart, you believe in God. You just believe in the wrong God. And reminding me that you're either humble or you're about to be. And the humility of telling my mom, after all the years of thinking I was better than her, that I was smarter and more successful than she was, the humility in the moment to realize why my mom was who she was and the impact she had her whole life on her community, on women's rights. She fought when she got divorced. My dad left at 5 years old. Women couldn't get credit without a man's cosign in 1976. My mom fought for women to be able to have their own credit.
Wow.
These are the things my mom did. Never had a penny to her own name. Gave everything away and received less than she gave. But she empowered so many people with humility and faith and wisdom. And I use that humility, faith, and wisdom to shorten the distance of resistance for the last 18 years, to make more money than I ever have, help more people than I ever dreamed of, and have more fun than I ever imagined. And that's my mission, because those skills I have, and I'm able and capable of communicating those and helping other people make a lot of money, help a lot of people, and have a lot of fun.
So I need to know, how did you pick yourself up out of that?
Great question. And a lot of people ask two critical questions. One, how the hell do you lose all that money?
That also.
So I didn't ask for help. I didn't ask for help. If I just would have asked someone to understand private banking and financing, I would have been fine. I just didn't know what I didn't know. And I thought I knew everything. I bought my own bullshit. And, you know, I learned a very, very valuable lesson that cost me about $100 million. But picking myself up was much easier. I got a mentor, Bob Proctor, a very famous mentor. Bob Proctor told me that I was great at making a lot of money. I made my first $1 million right out of law school, multimillionaire before I was 30, worth over $100 million in my 30s, ran the most notable sports agency. All these things were easy for me. But he said, David, you don't know how to keep it. So what I want you to do in your own way, I want you to save $2 million. I want you to save $2 million. That's all I want you to do. And so I got hyper-focused, not on making money, on saving it.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you, he said, as dumb as it sounds, I want you to have $2 million in your bank account. I don't want you to. So I learned about the idea of making more money, but also saving it by spending less. Because the majority of my life, I spent with more than enough of everything once I graduated school. So I bought tons of stuff I didn't need to impress people I didn't like. And Bob Proctor broke that habit. I now, in very short amount of time, saved $2 million, changed my behaviors, shifted my paradigm from I'll be happy when, I need more, to very simply, for the sake of what? I was really saving $2 million for the sake of being able to make more money, help more people, and have more fun, to empower others to be happy. I didn't know it at the time, but for the sake of what is how I live my life. And I'm very clear on my mission. And ironically, the commissions follow.
Do you want to talk about the doing business with dicks? Because I do think that, to your point, like there is some, I do believe there's this like professional karma that like when you do good, you do receive. Like I think that, and that you're living proof of that, and that you don't have to be a dick to be successful.
Well,
and I think.
Well, I want to know, from losing everything, like as someone who's like has a chronic illness, like my life changed greatly after that. Like I'm like, okay, when I feel good, I'm so much happier and I enjoy life, I think, more than the average person. So like after losing everything, do you feel like you're more appreciative for what you have? And maybe you were that dick before. Getting to your dick, don't be into dicks.
Yeah. So I wrote my book about and gave it probably the best title I ever could think of.
Ever.
I mean, even when I was writing it, people were like, I want to buy that book. I'm like, it's not written yet. I just have it up on my laptop. It's called Don't Do Business with Dicks. And it's really about surrounding yourself not only with the right people, but the right ideas. My problem was I wasn't really a dick to other people. I just did stupid shit that created bad causes. for myself and my family. I wasn't probably the best father I could be or the best husband I could be, but I was a good husband and a good father. I just did dumb shit, drugs and alcohol. And then I would do dumber shit when I utilized drugs and alcohol because I had self-loathing issues. I remember sitting on my bed thinking, I hate my mom, I hate my dad, I hate my best friend, and I hate my wife, because they were the only four people that cared enough about me to tell me the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the day I realized, the day after my wife told me she was leaving me, that I better take stock in who I was and what I wanted to become, forced me to take inventory of self. And thank goodness my wife didn't leave me. And she gave me an interesting ultimatum, which is really 18 years later, something that was, you know, life-changing for me. She never said, if I catch you doing drugs or I catch you drinking or I catch you going to a strip club, I'm going to leave you. She said, if I catch you not trying to change, if I catch you not trying to change, I will leave.
Hmm.
And so it was a whole different mindset. There was no fear of slipping or making a mistake or this pressure that I was being controlled. It was simply, if what you say is true and you care about me and this family more than anything, then you're going to take care of yourself so you can take care of us. And if I don't see you trying to do that by taking stock in yourself and living with those values, I'm out of here. And that made a big difference. So I think moving from that place of perception of, you know, pursuit of my potential changed my life, and really has helped me change other people's lives too. It's this humble approach, a predisposition mm-hmm. of surrender. And a lot of people try to take a disposition of surrender and they get confused. They think it's a passive. Once you're predisposed to surrendering to God, then you can kick some ass. And you start identifying all the people and the ideas that are interfering with your potential. And so I fired people from my life. My wife had some ultimatums about firing some people from my life. But I'm also very conscious about the things I watch and read and drink and eat. I start, by the way, with the five things God tells us you need for a human.
So you do believe in God now. You gave up on that. Not believing in
yeah,
God situation.
I believe in God. I believe in something omniscient, all powerful, bigger than me, loves me, protects me more than my mom. I'm a faith-based person. I believe in your God and my God. So mm-hmm. as long as it's bigger than us and loves you more than your mom. So, but to the context of understanding, you know, this idea of how to do this, I really changed my perspective with I am, this is what I'm doing to interfere with it. And I got rid of, in this book, Don't Do Business with Dicks, it talks about fear, reaction, and response to fear. It talks about how many people don't realize how much negativity is interfering with their potential. And so we can go through places, situations, events, historical relevances, defining moments. All of these different things are also dicks in your life.
Mm-hmm.
The most obvious are the people. And the emotional expense and interference that's created by them is extremely quantitative in its interference to your potential.
What are the signs that you may be working with dicks?
Oh, it's very easy. There's five levels of intention
awesome.
That you realize. So yeah, one, from what people say. If someone says a dickish thing, they're a dick. If they do dickish things, they're a dick. If they think different dickish things, they're a dick. If they, you know, believe dickish things, they're a dick. And if they feel dickish things, they're a dick. So I look to see, are you doing, saying, thinking, feeling, and believing aligned with positivity? Or are you trying to be a dick with one of those five intentions?
And I know we have
if it smells on. Like a dick and it looks like a dick and it seems like
yeah,
a dick,
and
it's probably
like a dick.
It's probably a dick.
I'm always curious because one of your most listened to episodes was Likeable Badass. We were talking about how people that are likable badasses just excel more in their careers, and people that are just like these cold bitches, this was a women's empowerment type of book,
sure.
are actually not as successful because people don't want to help them. But what makes someone become a dick? Do you think it's typically circumstance? I've always thought that it's, like, to your point, a bit of self-loathing and almost honestly, like, insecurity that makes them want to break other people down to be at their level. Like, just curious, as we diagnose behaviorally, what's your perspective on what makes someone a dick? Like, why they become a dick?
The wrong responses to the reaction to fear. You see, everybody's afraid and everybody has an instant and obvious reaction to fear. It's part of our human experience. There's an ego that reacts mm-hmm. automatically. So we automatically have a need to be right, a need to be offended, a need to be separate, inferior, superior, anxious, frustrated, angry, guilty, resentful, worried. Everybody has this, everyone, the nice people and the dicks. Mm-hmm. And so the difference between the nice people and the dicks are that the nice people, when they react with anger, frustration, fear, these reactions, they respond by stopping, breathing, dropping, recollecting, reminding, and remembering with their source, with God. They're aligned with ease. And there's a various spectrum of how well people do, and it's equated in a quantitative measurement of time. How long does it take you to get back to ease? The difference of a dick is that they're going to resist that reaction, go over and under it, through it, lie to it, manipulate it, cheat it, deny it, or project it onto you. And so the differentiator lies within how long does it take you to get back to ease, back to that center, this unbelievable higher self that we all are. Some people never get there. They're real dicks. But so many people at times, good people, become desperate or react or resist their own reaction to fear in the wrong way. And so they go over it, under it, through it, around it, lie to it, manipulate it, cheat it, deny it, or project it onto you. Mm-hmm. And when we find those people, if we can't help them heal, right? Because angry people do angry things. You know, good people do good things. And so I always say, you know, it's always my process when someone's a dick is to pray for their happiness and let them fall away or fire them from my life.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Fall away or fire out.
I like it. Amazing. Well, I just want to thank you so much for coming on. And this is exciting. The title of your book's incredible. The branding that I like, as you can tell, from Behavior Bitches. It's catchy and good. So where can everyone find you, get a copy of your book, all your work? Tell us where.
Thank you. So the book will be available when this comes out to pre-order. It'll be launching at the Super Bowl, which I've been to for 35 years. The best way, I'm everywhere. So you can email me directly, david@dmeltzer.com. And anyone that pre-orders my book will get my other book for free. I'll send it to you, pay for shipping and the book. So please reach out. But just Google me if you don't remember my email, David Meltzer. To a blessing of my mom, I just love to remind people, my name, David Meltzer, it may help you remember it. My mom named me purposefully. It means beloved servant. And my mom passed, but it means, a lot to me to live up to my name. I laugh. When I was little, my mom used to say, "You're not living up to your name." I intentionally gave you that name. And so I will live my life as a beloved servant. And although the title of my book is funny, there's some great empowering practices that can help people be happy and to live in abundance. And thank you both for providing me this platform to share with your community. And anything I can do in return, please let me know.
Thank you so much. You are so beloved by us already. And I know that all the listeners are going to definitely, you're just very lovable. And your mom, you took a break while you were having you got off the path for a little bit, you're absolutely living into that beloved servant.
She's got to be proud. Yeah.
She's got to be very proud of you. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys.